Hello, and welcome to the Jesuit Border Podcast. This podcast explores the humanitarian response along the U.S.-Mexico border from a Catholic perspective. My name is Brian Strasburger.
And I'm Joe Noya. We're with Del Camino Jesuit Border Ministries, located in the Diocese of Brownsville, Texas.
This podcast aims to humanize the migrant experience by sharing stories from our ministry and highlighting some of the amazing work that people are doing along the border and throughout the country.
The Jesuit Border Podcast is edited and produced by the Jesuit Conference of Canada in the U.S. and hosted by the Jesuit Post. Let's begin.
Vamos!
In this episode, we're going to talk about Palm Sunday.
We'll be interviewing Michael DeBruhl, who is the shelter director at Casa del Sagrado Corazón in El Paso, Texas, and also a former Border Patrol agent. It's a fascinating interview, so stay tuned for that. But first, let's talk a little bit about Palm Sunday. It's coming up this Sunday, a day where we gather at Mass with palm branches handed out to everyone. We actually begin the Mass with a reading of Jesus' entry into Jerusalem and how the people laid palm branches out as Jesus passed by on a donkey. It's about this warm welcome of the people of Jerusalem to Jesus as he enters. We then process into the church and continue with Mass. Well, this warm welcome demonstrated as we carry our palms is really not the kind of welcome that migrants necessarily receive as they come to our country. One new program that started in this past year is called the Family Expedited Removal Management, or FERM for its initials. And that's a process in which a migrant can be removed from the U.S. in as quick as 30 days, obviously, thus the word expedited removal. It's about getting people out as quickly as possible.
Also, family.
And family. So we're not talking about single adults, but we're talking, in this case, expedited removal has existed for a while, but this FERM program is specifically for families. So instead of laying palms at their feet, the head of the household, maybe the mother or the father, is usually given a GPS monitoring device that is most often an ankle monitor locked onto their legs. They have to maintain a specified curfew. They have to charge those ankle monitors daily. What we see is that within 10 to 14 days of their entry into the U.S., they're processing by Border Patrol, they have this ankle monitor, and they have a notice to report for a credible fear interview in their destination city. It's basically an interview in which they have to express the reasons why they came to the U.S., and those reasons have to be rooted in fear of persecution in their home country. If they fail that interview, that again is scheduled within just 2 weeks basically, they have very limited resources to appeal the decision before they get ordered removed from the country. That is to say, deported back to their home country. A lot of organizations are elevating concerns about this program, especially for the lack of due process. Less than 3% of migrants enrolled in this program get legal representation in that short, very short time window. When this program started last summer, it was in just 4 U.S. cities, but now it's expanded to nearly 50. And so what we've seen in this new year, in 2024, is that the Humanitarian Respite Center, the shelter that we visit in McAllen, Texas, twice a week, when we encounter migrants who had entered between ports, that is to say they didn't come through a port of entry with a CBP-1 appointment that we sometimes talk about, what we're now seeing is the vast majority of those people that entered between ports are wearing ankle monitors. Now, some of them are enrolled in just an alternative to detention. That is to say, they're given this ankle monitor as opposed to detaining them. But when you look at their paperwork, there are a good handful, maybe half of the people we see with ankle monitors, who are enrolled in FIRM. So when we're there, when we're at the HRC, we try to provide some orientation because people are often confused about why they have these ankle monitors on and what is happening to them. You know, I think just recently when we were there, talked to an Ecuadorian father and son, Angel, and his teenage son, Santiago. I mean, they traveled from Ecuador in South America. They crossed 8 countries, traversed through the Darien Gap by foot. They journeyed for over a month, then arrived at the U.S.-Mexico border. Well, you know, like many migrants, they didn't understand the complex dynamics of our border. And just as they'd crossed 7 other national borders on their way, they swam across the river. They weren't trying to hide or sneak in. They presented themselves to Border Patrol, said, "Look, we are here to seek asylum." Why are they doing that? Well, because the situation in Ecuador right now, now this doesn't make it in the U.S. news very often because there's so many other things going on around the world, but the situation in Ecuador is really not great. Right. The country is just reeling from violence right now, growing influence by drug cartels. There was a big incident in January in which a live television broadcast was interrupted by gunmen who took 20 people as hostages. I mean, it's really disturbing the kind of things that are happening. Last year, an anti-corruption politician was violently assassinated. And so in the midst of this environment, many people have fled for their lives, like Angel and Santiago. They come to the U.S., but instead of seeing a warm welcome, like palms being laid at their feet, they have an ankle monitor strapped on their leg. The CFI for Angel, the Credible Fear interview for Angel and Santiago was in New York City in just 10 days. So there wasn't much I can do other than share the information of an organization that provides counseling to migrants before their interview and just tell them to trust him that everything's in God's hands now. But the truth is the prospects for Angel and Santiago are not great. If they fail that interview, they'll be sent right back to Ecuador with a ban on reentering the United States. And I just think as a Christian country, we have to consider the way that we respond to and receive people who come to our doors. What kind of welcome do we want to offer? Can we be consistent with the ideals we profess and the policies that we implement?
Talking about this desire to be consistent, this need to be consistent, our guest is someone who strives to live consistently. He's someone who is served honorably and generously as a Border Patrol agent, and he now serves honorably and generously as a director of a shelter for migrants. This consistency and continuity, it's an important part of his story, and consistency like his is impressive because, you know, being morally consistent, it's no easy thing. Like, it's really, really, really hard to do. We fail so often.
And one of the things that's striking about him is his desire to be consistent in these two very different environments. You think about Border Patrol, which we often think as kind of a policing force guarding the border, and a migrant shelter is more of a welcoming center. But in both cases, he feels this desire to do his job honorably and generously.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's not an easy thing to do. And like, we know that from our own experiences of just being humans, you know, that we fail and we backslide. That's a part of the universal human experience. And, you know, speaking of Palm Sunday, the church highlights this own issue of consistency. We begin the Palm Sunday liturgy with the hosannas, with those palm branches, welcoming Jesus, celebrating his entry into Jerusalem. And just a few minutes later, we're saying, crucify him. During the gospel narrative.
That's right, because as people remember, Palm Sunday is the day that we do the whole passion narrative where you've got multiple people doing the different voices and the congregation is part of it as well. And so it's that whole long reading of the passion. And, you know, we as the congregation of the mass have the line to yell out, crucify him, which is really striking when you think about that contrast between beginning with the palms and Hosanna, Hosanna, here he comes entering this city, to crucify him.
I know it's kind of jarring, and at the same time, it's a pretty accurate anthropology.
Right.
But, you know, thankfully, the Mass doesn't end there with the crucify him, and then it's Mass is ended. Okay, go home, everybody. Be sad. Burp. No, it's like it doesn't end there. Like, we return to the hosannas in the Eucharistic liturgy. We're given this opportunity in the Mass to double down on praising God and not let those crucify him have the last word. And I think of all the decisions that are made by so many people here on the border, decisions that represent that commitment to the Hosanna. I think of, you know, those volunteers who travel from all over the country to spend time at the Humanitarian Respite Center, and all the visitors that we've hosted, and the people of, a little shout out to my own home diocese.
Shout out.
Yeah, to the diocese of Pensacola, Tallahassee, who so generously make rosaries and send them to us so that we can give them to the migrants, and the Immaculate Heart of Mary sisters, Daughters of St. Paul, Franciscans of Redemption. So many people, so many actors here on the border committing themselves for the good of others and the glory of God. And it's so much of what I think perseverance, holy perseverance, comes down to this choosing to say Hosanna and not letting any moment of crucify him have the final word.
That's right. I think that's so important, is that even as we fall, it's how do we get back up again? And that's kind of the Christian journey. And we live that even in that single liturgy of Palm Sunday, where we begin with the Hosanna, and then we have that fall crying out, crucify him, and then we come around to celebrate the rest of the Eucharistic liturgy. And so that kind of transformation is something that's important. And, you know, some of that consistency of trying to live that Christian message and do so dutifully is something that our guest for today's episode is really a good model of. So we've got a fascinating interview with Michael DeBruhl, who worked for over 25 years at a Border Patrol agent and now is running a migrant shelter in El Paso. So you're going to be really, he's got a great interview. So stay tuned for that coming up next. We are very excited to welcome to this episode of the podcast Michael DeBruhl. He's a former Border Patrol agent and the current shelter director at Casa del Sagrado Corazon at Sacred Heart Church in El Paso, Texas. Thanks for joining us for this interview.
It's my pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Of course. Yeah, maybe a first question just to get things started. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about the history of the shelter there and how it was that you got involved with it?
Well, the as far as shelters go, I mean, the shelter Casa del Sagrado Corazon is actually very new. We've only been open a little over a year. We just celebrated the year anniversary. The shelter opened in December of 2022 due to an influx of migrants in the area. Father Garcia here threw open the doors because there was a need to do that, and he did. We had about 1,000 people surrounding the church and shelter at that time. So it was really something amazing to see. Regarding how I got here, I mean, that's kind of a roundabout story, if you will. But what happened was that I retired from the Border Patrol, and I, just as we all do at some point, I started hearing all these things about migrants, that they were criminals and rapists and things like that, things that I knew not to be true. And then when, you know, the administration was separating children from their families, et cetera, I mean, these were just things that I could not abide by and things that I knew not to be true. So, I mean, just as an old retired guy, I said, well, what can I do as one person? But then when the influx happened, Father Garcia was casting about for someone to help him here at the shelter. A couple of people gave him my name. And so he called me and I showed up to volunteer. I volunteered for a couple of months. And then here I am. I was asked to come on staff as director. Yeah. And it, so it just kind of happened just like that. No one was more surprised than I that I found myself in the middle of what was that significant influx into the United States.
As you also said, you were a Border Patrol agent. So how did you get involved with that as well?
Well, that's interesting because my father was a Border Patrol agent in the 50s for about 5 years. And then after that, he began to work at the ports of entry here in El Paso. And he did that for like 30 years. And so when I came back from the military, I had a bunch of odd jobs. And so he told me one day, hey, you know what? You need a job. And I was like, well, I have a job. I'm a DJ. Obviously, I don't need another job. He's like, no, that's not what I meant. I mean, you need a job with maybe like a pension or, you know, some kind of a future. And I said, oh, well, okay. So we were walking through a mall one day and there was a job fair there. And he said, hey, that table right there, Border Patrol, sign up. So more to appease him than anything else, I did. So through that, I got to work all along the 2,000-mile border, which was great wow. because you can just stay in one place as a Border Patrol agent your whole career. So that was great. I got to work on the whole 2,000-mile border on these high-risk operations. So I really had a really great career. The Border Patrol was good to me. I worked all over the place and went from the bottom all the way to a pretty high position. So it was good.
That's so fascinating. What an amazing career, and incredible that it took you all over and that you got to see this whole border. I think sometimes even that's kind of a misconception. People underestimate the size and distance of the U.S.-Mexico border. I mean, it's 2,000 miles long. I think it's got the most number of legal crossings that happen of any national border per year. And so it's a really substantial border, and there's a lot of movement along it, and there's a lot of moving actors. You know, there's people crossing the bridge every day to go to work, or there's people going on Sundays yes. across the border to go to mass with their grandma or otherwise. And so, and then there's also, there's migrants that come, there's asylum seekers that are seeking relief. There's Border Patrol agents, there's nefarious actors trying to bring illicit yep. things in or out of the country. And so it's a really very dynamic place. And so I wonder your perspective, 25 years working along the entirety of the 2,000-mile border, what are some perspectives that you could offer our listeners that they might not otherwise know without having the ample experience that you yourself have?
Well, you know, I mean, the border and applying immigration law on the border is very complex. I think that even those in Congress who talk about the border don't really know all the aspects of how immigration runs and et cetera. So the interesting dynamic now is that, you know, it's Americans want a secure border. And then that is weighed against, in my mind, a just general right that a person has to migrate. That has happened for thousands of years. And I consider that a right of you know, every living person. But those two things don't necessarily have to be opposed to each other. So the issue for, I think, us as Americans is how do we have those two things work in concert? And I think that's our dilemma now. As far as my perspective, I think that perhaps I can bring some fidelity to this discussion. I mean, maybe that's my role. I don't know. Now as a migrant coordinator and then as a Border Patrol agent, talking about what's true and what's not true and kind of the right to migration versus securing the border. How does that look? How should that look? What are the discussions that we should have, et cetera? So, you know, you hear things like we're being invaded. So, you know, you have to really take the long look at traffic across the southwest border to get a good picture of what that looks like and what that has looked like historically. For example, in 1986, you had about 1.68, I believe, million people come across the border, almost 2 million. Also, again, in 2000. My point is, this is not the first time that we've had significant migration across the southern border, not to mention that in those years, there were no fences, there was no cameras, there were, you know, between 2,000 and 5,000 Border Patrol agents, and now we have 21,000 Border Patrol agents. We have significant infrastructure, you know, 700 miles of fencing, and cameras that can see for miles, and sensors, comparatively speaking, the border's pretty secure now, you know. But again, this isn't the first time that we've had significant migration across the border. So what is the difference today? In those years, you know, the public heard nothing about the fact that there were almost 2 million people that had crossed the border, you know, in one of those years. So nobody knew about it. Nobody talked about it. It was not an issue. So now we're experiencing the same thing. So what is the difference? I mean, why is it such a big issue? Perhaps because we're all talking about it, or people are talking about it, or because it's being politicized. But the biggest difference that I see today is that now everybody has papers. So whereas before people came across the border, they had no wherewithal to get any documents. So they just melted into the fabric of the United States. You didn't see them. You didn't hear about them. I mean, if you went to a restaurant, they were probably cooking or serving. Or if you went, if you traveled, they were probably working in the hotels, etc. But other than that, you really didn't hear anything about people that were crossing illegally. You didn't really see them. They didn't want to be seen. They just wanted to make a living. Now everyone has papers, so they're right here. You know, we have to deal with this situation. So I think that's what makes it different. I think that, a lot of people going to Chicago, New York, Denver, they're being inundated. So the big issue for me is how do we deal with this? What should we do? What's the right thing to do? And to me, it's more of a population influx problem for these cities than actually a migrant problem. I mean, so they need more schools. They need more money. They need some way to deal with this. At one point, I was speaking to people from the mayor's office in Chicago, and they said, you know, people and cities come to us every day asking, how can we get migrants into our communities or our cities? The fact is that we don't have really any infrastructure or methodology to get migrants to where they need to be. And also, you know, there's 8 to 11 million jobs that we can't fill in the United States. Why aren't we talking about a job program, some kind of a migrant job program? Because everybody's pushing to the asylum route, and asylum is not built for that. Asylum is built for specific reasons. People were being persecuted, etc. And a lot of these migrants are looking for a better life, and so they don't necessarily fit into that asylum path. So I think we as a nation need to look at, and the problem is that we're not talking, so it's very difficult.
I feel like you really said something very telling when you said that the problem is we're not talking to each other. And in such a polarized society like we have, there can be such a tendency for people on different sides of issues to really demonize each other and to vilify one another. And something that's unfortunately I've seen, and perhaps you've seen it too, is sometimes there can be a tendency for people who advocate on behalf of migrants to try and vilify and demonize Border Patrol and people who work in that in that line of work. Are there any what are some of the misconceptions that those who are demonizing have? What is something that you would wish people would know so that this demonization can cease and this polarization can be present? We can actually start talking to each other, you know, as people who are humanizing each other.
Right. Well, I think there's, you know, obviously demonization on both sides. But yes, I think that I'm pro Border Patrol, and Border Patrol agents are just like you and I, you know, looking for a job. Perhaps they put in a bunch of applications to, you know, FBI, CIA, their local law enforcement in the city, and they were called by the Border Patrol. So then they join the Border Patrol, and then you have to decide if that's the job for you. So whoever stays, I mean, it's difficult to get in. Interview hundreds of people to get one Border Patrol agent.
Wow.
But besides that, I think that what people don't understand is that you cannot be a Border Patrol agent and not be affected by the humanity of what you see every day. I think in many aspects, the Border Patrol agents are much closer than anyone else to the reality of what happens during what is an arduous trek for people. When I was working, I found dead people. I found people who were dying. I found children out in the desert and in the montes, they called it. So I think the Border Patrol agents know more than anyone kind of what is happening out there. And the Border Patrol agent in the Border Patrol, they're very strict. Like if you do something wrong or something you're not supposed to do, you get fired. Generally, agents are just like you and I. They're affected by the humanity of what is happening. And so I think that's a big misconception for people.
Yeah, it sounds like kind of both directions we have to be careful, right? You don't want to see that one migrant commits a crime in the United States and then paint all migrants with that brush. And in the same way, you don't want to hear the report of abuse by a Border Patrol agent of migrants or of his job or whatever and paint all Border Patrol agents with that same brush, right? That kind of gets beyond the more human experience and encounter of saying, you know, that we're all people and we're not perfect, but there are a lot of good people, a lot of great people who are migrating. There are a lot of great people who are members of their important members of their community, care for their family, trying to do their job as best they can as a Border Patrol agent. I think we have to name and acknowledge that, and that's what helps kind of overcome the polarization and demonization and bring people together to talk. And another thing that comes to mind is, you know, it's important that we have these stories that impact us, these moments that shape the way we think and approach other people. And certainly, I'm sure your work, 25 years with the Border Patrol, there's a lot of moments and stories that really impacted you. I wonder if there's one incident you could think of or one moment you remember that had a deep impact on you and the way you think about the border or migration or otherwise in your career with the Border Patrol.
Well, gosh, a lot of things happened during those years. I think when I was a field agent one time, there was a mother, she and they had obviously been walking for days. And I remember it was like 108 that, they were exhausted. And I took her baby from her. And it was, I think that it was just so, they were just on the verge of like being overtaken by the elements, you know, and I think I was very affected by that, that day when I took that child from her. And so I always kind of remember that. I think that was a moment for me when I felt really affected by these, the things that we saw every day. I don't know why it was that day. You know, I don't know why it was that moment, but that always kind of stayed with me. And, you know, the thing is that my father told me when I got home, that the day I got home from the Border Patrol Academy, he told me, hey, listen, you are not a customs agent. You're not dealing with widgets, if you will. You're not dealing with products. You're dealing with human beings. So always treat everyone with respect. Don't ever eat your lunch in front of somebody unless you're going to share it with them. Make sure that you apply justice if you're involved in that in a humane and positive manner, et cetera. So that's one of the things that as a Border Patrol agent, you have to remember why you're there every day, who you are and what you are. And you have to be sure of that when you're out there because these are the decisions that you're making. These are the actions that you're taking every day. So you really have to know who you are. So I kind of carry that with me every day when I was out in the field doing that job.
Those are just profound life lessons as well. This need to know who you are. This need for such an attentiveness to the other person, to their own experience, to their own suffering, and that should impact how you behave and how you compose yourself around that person. And this, when you talk about knowing who you are and this duty to be a person who treats others with justice and who treats people with respect. It's attention there, that not eating lunch around them unless you're I hear that, and then I think of just what continuity there is. There's such great continuity because also I think of the work you're doing now at the shelter as kind of as an extension and a continuation of that, being attentive to the needs of the other person, sensitive to their situation, to their plight, and your own duty to respond accordingly. And do you find that this is such an obvious and even dumb question, I'm going to go ahead and ask it anyway. Are there any kind of like palpable ways that you have had your own experience as an agent directly influencing your work as director of the shelter?
Gosh, I think that just generally speaking, the two jobs are maybe more closely related than people would think. You know, so you talk about doing the right thing, you talk about treating people with respect, etc. All those things are really universal. When I was in the Border Patrol and then now here in this job, listen to people, understand what they're saying to you, what they're really saying, attending to their needs, applying whatever rules and policies that we work in these worlds, and applying them the same way to everyone, etc. I mean, when you're a Border Patrol agent, you're applying laws for the United States, but those are also you know, how you apply those laws is, you know, what's significant. And the same thing over here, we work within the policies, and to a great degree, we work within the policies of the Customs and Border Protection and DHS and ICE and et cetera. So we just, we're just doing it from the other side. But, and it was a great boon to, when I started volunteering, to know kind of how everything worked, to understand what all the paperwork and said, what it meant, how people were supposed to do things, et cetera. So it's funny, but the two jobs are pretty closely, much closer related than you would think they are.
A shelter in El Paso has been in the news recently a lot, and it's not your shelter. It's Annunciation House, a big shelter with a long history of helping migrants and being part of the community there in El Paso, because the Texas Attorney General, Ken Paxton, has sued Annunciation House for withholding client records. He's accused them of incentivizing migrants to make their journey here, and seems to be pretty clear in his desire to shut them down. So I'm wondering, as a shelter director locally in El Paso, if you could share what the community response has been and how what the environment is around this case right now.
Well, I mean, what strange times we live in that the government of Texas is opposing the federal government, and they are at odds regarding applying immigration law. So you talk about Ruben Garcia, who I started volunteering for some years ago and in the Annunciation House. Ruben Garcia has been in El Paso so long and supporting migrants for so long, 40 some plus years, that CBP calls him directly every morning and tells him how many people they are going to release, and then he finds shelter for all those people. That is how closely he works with the federal government. It's amazing. And he has knitted together a loose coalition of migrant support, religious organizations, civic organizations, etc., groups that are supporting migrants. And this is what he does every day, is he finds shelter through those organizations, this loosely affiliated group that really forms what we call an Annunciation House. So to find him under attack by the state is just really mind-boggling. I mean, trying to shut Annunciation House down. What has been disillusioning, you know, being a Texan, being here in Texas, is that everything that Ken Paxton has done, I'm sorry, and everything the government has done, and of course, Ken Paxton works directly for him in Texas, has been really to create more chaos. So again, this takes us away from what I talked about, and that is, you know, how do we as a country deal logically, humanely with this situation?
Yeah, it's so counterproductive. I think some of the policies that are being enacted here by the state of Texas that are really just provoking more chaos and creating more chaos. And I certainly think that's true when we talk about the attack on Annunciation House. I can certainly say definitively that this idea that the shelters along the border are incentivizing migration is just
completely ill-founded. I've never met a migrant in northern Mexico said, yeah, you know, part of the reason I made this journey is because I heard there's shelters that will house me for 2 or 3 days in South Texas before I make my journey north. I mean, it's just, it's ludicrous to even think that's part of kind of the incentive for a migrant journey. And so what's going to happen if you shut down a shelter like the shelters run by Annunciation House or other ones run by Catholic Charities, you know, the Sacred Heart in El Paso? What you're going to do is just create more chaos, more people who then don't have a place to stay even just for a couple of nights as they're making their arrangements for their destination, their final journey. And so then that impacts everyone in the city of El Paso who are citizens of the state of Texas. And so why would we say, you know, this charitable work providing and meeting a great need is something that we need to eliminate? I don't imagine what world he thinks that's going to create other than building more chaos and creating this, exaggerating even more this kind of political issue.
Yeah, and you know, this helps DHS, Customs and Border Protection. They don't want chaos on the border. They don't want a bunch of people in the streets. You know, that's why they call Ruben Garcia every day, because they want to see order and support on the border, because it supports both elements. It supports DHS and their mission, and it supports the migrants in their short time on the border, seeking respite and refuge. It helps all sides. I'm not sure what he's trying to accomplish, because we really should all be working together to make this better for everyone. This does not help the United States, what he's doing. So I think that we just need to be in a better place. Just as, you know, my father said, to always try to do the right thing.
I just can't think of enough of how fortunate the shelter you're at is to have you there, you with your background, your ability to speak the language, you know, the jargon of the border, and you know the jargon of advocacy and helping the migrants. You have this big picture perspective, you know? And this big picture perspective allows you to see what really is the real in these moments, in these situations. And I think this kind of these touch points with reality is part of, I think, a promise of heaven in many ways, where things are put into perspective, where we begin to understand, where we see that wisdom of God, that goodness of God, that love of God. It's a part of a strong image of heaven. And so a question that I have for you, when you think of heaven, what are some of the images that come to mind? What is heaven when you think of heaven?
Well, gosh, that's a difficult question. I'm not a very like religious person. Well, let me tell you that I did not, as the story I tell you about how I got here, I was not driven by a calling necessarily, or religious reasons brought me to the shelter, but it was more that I could not abide by what the country was doing, how the leadership in the country was reacting to migrants and spreading lies that I knew not to be true. When I came on the scene in late December or mid December of 2022, and I was out in the street one day, and there were, as I mentioned, 1,000 people outside, and also out there was NBC News, ABC News, CBS News, MSNBC, Fox News, CNN, Al Jazeera, Univision, etc. Wow. So no one was more surprised than I to find myself in the middle of what the world was seeing as the influx into the United States. So a few days later, Father Garcia and I were talking, and we were talking about the shelter itself and religion. I told him, well, you know, I'm not very religious, Father. And he said, well, I'm not sure about that. And, you know, I always think about that, because in sometime later I found myself in the shelter and I realized that that I was where I was supposed to be. So I think that sometimes God works in mysterious ways, as we know. Sometimes God puts you where you're supposed to be, and you do have a religious calling, but you're just not aware of it. So I think that that is what this whole thing has taught me, I think. So when I think about heaven, I'm not sure. Although the gentleman who told Father Garcia that he should call me, one of the gentlemen, I told him, okay, Todd, because one time he came into the shelter, he's a Marist brother, and it was, we had 160 people in there, capacity is 120. And I said, okay, Todd, you see what you're responsible for. And he said, well, listen, at least you won't have to go to purgatory. So I think that although I did know it at the time, and although I thought that I was coming for reasons other than religious reasons, I think that I know without any doubt that I am in the right place. When things get difficult, when things are tough, when I have hard days, etc., I am buoyed by the knowledge that I'm in the right place and I'm where I'm meant to be.
I think that alone can be a beautiful image of heaven, of being in the right place, right? To have that sense that we are in the right place. I think it's a great, great image of finding that fulfillment and that maybe kind of eternal destination that we long for. And places so important. You've been to a lot of them. In fact, you, in your 25 years on the Border Patrol, you lived all along the 2,000-mile border, U.S.-Mexico border. And so just wanted to give you a little bit of an opportunity right now to tell our listeners why, in particular, the Rio Grande Valley and Brownsville is the best part. And maybe you could list the five reasons why the Rio Grande Valley is the best part of that 2,000-mile border. I don't know if you could just do that for me. Just completely impartially.
Top five reasons for being number one.
Okay, but I will tell you that the food is great in the valley. That's right. There. The Mexican food. They have the best tamales also. Mm-hmm. And the people are great in the valley. I worked in the valley, as a matter of fact, for a while. Right. I did an exchange program when I was in the senior executive training, and I actually traded with a Office of Field Operations. What was he? He was a director, and he was in charge of like three ports of entry and the airport in McAllen. And so I went and did his job for like 3 months, I think. And so I lived over there in McAllen, and it was great. I just loved it.
That's great.
Whether it's the best city on the border.
Oh, hey, okay, wait, you're breaking up.
We're
going through a tunnel.
Michael, we're super grateful for your interview, for all the insights that you've shared from your personal history and background. Thank you for all that you do, and keep up that great work.
Great. Well, thank you. And thank you for spreading the word and ensuring that everyone knows how wonderful the valley is.
Well, that wraps up our episode for this week. We're grateful to Michael DeBrule for joining us.
Remember to subscribe to this podcast to hear more about the U.S.-Mexico border from a Catholic perspective. You can visit our website at delcamino.org.
If you're curious about Jesuit life or know someone who is, visit beajesuit.org to learn more about a religious vocation to the Society of Jesus.
This podcast is edited and produced by the Jesuit Conference of Canada and the U.S. and hosted by the Jesuit Post.
We'll see you next time on the Jesuit Border Podcast.
Que Dios os bendiga.